Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Welcome to Route 51, Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today, our travels on Route 51 take us to the Prosperity and Poverty off-ramp and a roadside pointing to two different directions, to Wall Street on the right and Main Street on the left. At the top of the off-ramp, there's a toll booth, and the price is high. $750 billion to move forward, payable in nickels, dimes, quarters, and freshly printed currency. Today on Route 51, we look at the faltering U.S. economy and a proposal before Congress that is either a Wall Street bailout or a Main Street rescue plan, depending on who you talk to. And today we are talking to two of the most knowledgeable people in our part of the country, both from UW-Stevens Point. Randy Cray is a professor of economics and the director of the Central Wisconsin Economic Research Bureau. He'll help us sort through some of the ins and outs of the arcane and puzzling world of finance and tell us exactly what the economy means to North Central Wisconsin. Ed Miller is a professor of political science, and he'll help us sort through the political fallout from our economic meltdown as we head toward the November elections. Well, what do you think? Should we pass the bailout rescue plan? Will it help the economy? How has your life been affected by the turmoil on Wall Street? And who do you blame for it? We want you to join the conversation at 261-6371. That's 261-6371 or toll free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. If you call right now, you can get right in because our lines are open. And we'd like to welcome Randy Cray and Ed Miller on the phone from UW-Stevens Point. Good evening, I think, gentlemen.
Good evening.
We had another, 340-point drop in the stock market?
Yes.
So, Randy, why don't we start with you? How did we get into this mess in the first place?
Well, I think, as most people know by this juncture, we got into this mess through the subprime lending that was going on and the subsequent collapse in that activity. Basically speaking, what we had is a lot of lending going on to people that probably were not in a position to be able to pay back those loans. Some of the lending activity was probably of a questionable nature. Most people know that people were brought into this without full knowledge of what it was that they were getting into. But the real problem is that a lot of these mortgages, these subprime mortgages, were turned into securities. I will not go into the financial intricacies of that, other than to say that these things were pooled together and were put together in such a way that they were made into securities. And quite frankly, many, many financial institutions across the country bought these things. They borrowed money to buy them. It looked, at least on the surface, like it was a good proposition. I mean, after all, they're backed by real estate. Isn't that a good bit of collateral? As we well know now, that many of the people that were buying the properties were unable to pay the securities that these financial institutions bought simply became, worth much less than their face value. And as a result, some tremendous losses were incurred by some very well-known and large financial institutions across the country.
How did we end up lending money to, creating mortgages for people who couldn't pay them back?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I think that one of the things that was, of course, driving this is the greed motive, in the sense that there was the potential to make profits on this. And if these things were turned into pools where they could then back securities, in effect, you're passing the risk on to someone else. So there was a great incentive, I think, for a lot of people based upon, you know, greed on profit to do this sort of thing, to relax the standards. As most people know, some of the most basic and fundamental things were being violated in terms of just, you know, prudence. That is, you know, checking of income, those sorts of things, one's, you know, credit history and that. Basically, a lot of loans were made to individuals that probably should not have received those. And as a result, as I already said, many large financial institutions were holding bad paper, either the mortgages directly or the mortgage-backed securities.
Well, Randy, the if you're invested in a 401k, you can usually put your money in high-risk areas,
right,
or conservative areas. If you're invested in a conservative 401k, is that immune to this downturn, or are we hitting areas of the economy that we thought would never be impacted by something like this?
Once again, a very good question. I think that we're seeing that the pervasiveness of this financial problem is causing problems for 401ks, even ones that that have been invested in relatively safe, conservative items. For example, it was always thought that money market mutual funds were safe, and we discovered over the last month or so that some of the money market mutual funds had invested in these mortgage-backed securities and were having a difficult time maintaining the asset value. And the government had to essentially step in and guarantee the value of those accounts. So I want to make it perfectly clear to all the listeners as we speak that those accounts are now effectively insured by the government. But no one ever thought that a money market mutual fund could get itself into financial trouble. That is, holding securities that were worth much less than what people thought they were worth.
Randy Cray, a professor of economics at UW Stevens Point. We want to turn to Randy's colleague, Professor Ed Miller of the Political Science Department, to look at the fallout specifically in the national election race. Ed, judging from the polls, this economic crisis is benefiting Barack Obama. And let me just run down some of the polls that I pulled off the website just an hour ago. A New Democracy Corp poll in Ohio shows Obama leading McCain 49-43%. McCain pulled out of Michigan today, stopping literature drops and TV ads. Strategic Vision has Obama ahead 49-40% in Wisconsin, up by 3 in North Carolina, up by 9 in Pennsylvania, up by 8 in New Mexico. And the Gallup Daily has Obama 48-43%. Is it fair, Ed Miller, that Barack Obama is benefiting from this economic downturn?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, some of it that his increasing lead is a result of McCain's bump that he had right after the convention, which was late this year. And so it would, some of it, some of that baseline increase would be expected. However, there are some other factors involved in this particular area where McCain, and this has been emphasized by Obama, is not very strong in the economy. As a matter of fact, he made a statement that economy wasn't one of his things. He's since tried backtracked on that and mentioned this, the Commerce Committee and so forth that he's on. But nonetheless, the impression is McCain is really in foreign policy, and Obama is much more in domestic. In addition to that, McCain has, in the last, actually even 2 weeks, made contradictory statements. And so he said one thing one day about the crisis, like he wanted a commission, and then he wanted something else. He wasn't in favor of this plan. Now he's in favor of this plan, and so forth. And so and because of the plan, he wasn't going to go to the debates. Then he went to the debates. I think all of this has affected the president, the presidential election, and Obama's lead. And especially if you divide the lead by states, because, you know, we don't have really a national presidential election. It's really 51 presidential elections.
Well, some of these battleground states are real eye-openers for Obama to be ahead in North Carolina is, you know, that's near the cradle of the Confederacy. And
right.
Would have surprised people a few months ago.
Well, to some extent. I mean, you know, in North Carolina, of the southern states, it's one of the more liberal southern states. It has, you know, University of North Carolina and Duke, a lot of universities there, a lot of research facilities in North Carolina. So, plus you got a number of African Americans in North Carolina. And so you add all that up. I'm not surprised that there's certain states that he may be able to do well in. North Carolina is one. Florida is another, which he seems to be in the lead right now in Florida as well.
261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Toll free if you want to join the conversation. We're talking about the faltering economy and the political fallout with Randy Cray, who's a professor of economics at UW-Stevens Point, and Ed Miller, a professor of political science. There is a new package in front of the House right now, which the U.S. Senate passed. That package added about $100 billion worth of tax cuts and what some people are calling pork barrel projects onto the bill. And I believe that is the question that's being posed by our first caller, Rich in Athens. Rich, you're on Route 51. Good evening.
Yes, good evening, Glenn, and good evening, professors. I just have one comment, and I'd like to hear a little bit of discussion about it. Is I caught John McCain talking this morning about the pork that was all over the headlines that was added to this bill, and he's been vowing that he would, you know, put these people's names out there who are earmarking special projects and getting this, you know, this extra money that has nothing to do, you know, with the proposed bill. And, when he was talking about it, he obviously was in the chamber last night for the vote. And then, you know, when he's talking about it today, you know, we don't hear the names of those people. And I do think it's, you know, be a good policy. I'd like to see some follow up. And if anybody knows, I'd be very curious to know who were the senators that added, the extra, pork to this bill. And that's it. I'll take my comment up there.
All right. Thank you, Rich. Well, Ed Miller, do you have any names that you can name?
It's about $250 billion that in effect, these were like special tax breaks, such as including the children's archery, bow makers, the imported rum producers, racetrack owners. Some of those were removed, and some of those were you know, kept in.
Were those specific?
The ones that I mentioned were actually removed, but they had been in the original bill, and there were some others that were put in, and there were other things that were put in, such as the $250,000 guarantee on on savings accounts.
Well, let's come back to that in a second. But Ed, all those pork barrel projects, were they designed specifically for specific Republican or Democratic legislators in order to change their votes?
There were multiple reasons for them. One reason was exactly as you say, to make the bill the widest margin. That was one of the reasons. The second reason for adding those things is that not only did it increase the Senate support, but the idea is it would increase the House support among Republicans primarily. And it's very hard for a House member who voted against the bill then to vote for the bill, and could argue that these changes were made and therefore they could go along with the bill. And that was the second reason. Third thing about these things that were added, a number of them had actually been passed by the House in another bill and hadn't been acted on by the Senate. And so things such as the AMT correction or, you know, reduction in application of the AMT, which is the alternative minimum tax, which they've done every year, that's in a separate bill. So in order to placate other members that everybody knows this is going to pass, they put it in the same bill. And so that's the reason for doing that.
Randy, one of the things that was changed again was raising the FDIC insurance from $100,000 to $250,000. That was supported by both John McCain and Barack Obama. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yes, I do. And here's why I think that that's a good idea. the primarily why this was done is to help small businesses. There was reports coming out that small businesses were concerned about the availability of their money, and some evidence that some were, you know, wanting to withdraw or had withdrawn their money. Now, $250,000 to a small business is used to help, you know, pay expenses, you know, like heat, electricity, their employees, and whatever. You can imagine the problems that, you know, this would create for a small business if they could not have access to their funds. So, by having insurance of $250,000, the message is that you should have confidence that those dollars are going to be available, that you will have access to them, that the FDIC will make sure that you get that. You see, the problem is if firms and individuals, for example, withdraw their funds from financial institutions, this is a thing that we call disintermediation in economics, in financial economics, disintermediation. And it basically means that the intermediation function of bringing borrowers and savers is diminishing, is breaking down. You know, banks cannot do their thing. The savings from savers cannot be made to people that need to borrow those dollars for, you know, various uses. So basically, if you have disintermediation going on, you can see the economy slowly and slowly grinding to a halt as the liquidity starts to drain out of the financial institutions. So, yes, I think that was a very good thing to add to the bill.
Let me just point out on that, that guarantee has moved from $10,000 to the current $100,000. And Congress had passed a number of times raising it not to 250, but I believe it was to 200. And that was rejected by the administration. And the reason the administration rejected that was because the argument that it was what they call a moral hazard, that the fact is that if they guaranteed more money, that banks would be more reckless in their activities. So they thought if you kept it at $100,000, banks would be more conservative. Of course, we found out that wasn't true.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Randy Cray, professor of economics, Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, formerly Fiserv Health, providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
2616371, 2616371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. If you want to talk about the economy and the political fallout with Ed Miller and Randy Cray of UW-Stevens Point. Gentlemen, there's been quite a bit of opposition, as you know, to this bill in the House of Representatives. I'm going to play the comments of two people for you. One is a conservative Republican from Indiana, Mike Pence, the other a liberal Democrat from Ohio, Dennis Kucinich. Here are their comments on the bailout bill.
Our nation has been confronted by a crisis in our financial markets. The President and this Congress are right to act with all deliberate speed in addressing this crisis. And we now have a bill that promises to bring near-term stability to our financial turmoil. But at what price? Benjamin Franklin in 1759 said, and I quote, "They that can give up liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." Economic freedom means the freedom to succeed and the freedom to fail. The decision to give the federal government the ability to nationalize almost every bad mortgage in America interrupts this basic truth of our free market economy. It must be said that Republicans in this Congress improved this bill, but it remains, in my judgment, the largest corporate bailout in American history. Forever changes the relationship between government and the financial sector and passes the cost along to the American people, and I cannot support it.
There's conservative Republican Mike Pence. Here's liberal Democrat Dennis Kucinich.
The $700 billion bailout for Wall Street is being driven by fear, not fact. This is too much money in too short a time going to too few people while too many questions remain unanswered. Why aren't we having hearings on the plan we just received? Why aren't we questioning the underlying premise of the need for a bailout with taxpayers' money? Why have we not even considered any alternatives other than to give $700 billion to Wall Street? Why aren't we asking Wall Street to clean up its own mess? Why aren't we passing new laws to stop the speculation which triggered this? Why aren't we putting up new regulatory structures to protect the investors? How do we even value the $700 billion in toxic assets? Why aren't we directly helping homeowners with their debt burden? Why aren't we helping American families faced with bankruptcy? Why aren't we reducing debts for Main Street instead of Wall Street? Isn't it time for fundamental change in our debt-based monetary system so we can free ourselves from the manipulation of the by the Federal Reserve and the banks? Is this the United States Congress or the Board of Directors of Goldman Sachs? Wall Street is a place of bears and bulls. It's not smart to force taxpayers to dance with bears or to follow closely behind the bulls.
Ed Miller, this bill is being attacked. It's both sides against the middle.
Right, right. Well, your first comment was really, if you look back, the Secretary of the Treasury, Carnegie, at the time of the Depression, said the same thing. And you can see what happened there. And on the other side of it, that's the view of the public. That's the populist view. And the populist view is that it's helping out Wall Street and their CEOs at the expense of the taxpayers. And that is one of the reasons it was defeated initially, because in the House they received just tons of email and letters and other things. A lot of it was email and some faxes that were opposing this.
Dave Oldie said his email was going 90% against it. He ended up voting for the bill anyway.
Right, and that's unusual. A lot of them voted against it. If you look at the members of the Black Caucus, the Black radio talk show hosts were very much opposing this bill, arguing that that it did not help their everyday problems or their mortgage problems.
Ed, I've got to stop you there. Randy Cray, I want you to get the last word in. It's got to be a quick one before we break for news. Do you think this is a genuine emergency and we'll be in real trouble if something doesn't pass?
Yes, I do. I think that you'll find it very seldom that economists, agree. We're a contentious lot. We love to argue about things.
Very quickly.
But if you look at what even the economists are saying, that question whether or not this might be the appropriate plan, they state that this is a very urgent problem and it needs to be addressed, or we face
serious
problems.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Focus on Energy, presenting Wisconsin Solar Decade Conference, October 23rd at the Midwest Airlines Center in Milwaukee. Information on incorporating solar energy into businesses and homes at solardecade.com.
Another 300-point drop in the stock market today. Volatility reigns on Wall Street. Fear reigns on Main Street. We're talking about the faltering economy and its political implications and the implications for North Central Wisconsin with a couple of good friends from UW Stevens Point, Randy Cray, a professor of economics, and Ed Miller, a professor of political science. We want to hear from you. Should we pass the bailout rescue plan? Will it help the economy? How has your life been affected by the turmoil on Wall Street? And who do you blame for it? Here's the phone number, 261-6371. 261-6371 or toll free 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Randy, before we move forward, perhaps you could give us a general idea of the overall state of the national economy. How much trouble is it in, and how strong are the fundamentals at this point?
Okay, yes. If you look at the GDP, that's gross domestic product, it's the most basic measure of how the economy is doing. The economy is still expanding. The last number that I have was around 2% for the second quarter of July. So if you look at it from that standpoint, the economy is still increasing the amount of goods and services produced. However, there are, troubling signs. There are a lot of variables that are, feeding back to us to tell us that there is a brewing storm on the horizon. And it is certainly starting to show up in other measures. That's one of the things about economics. There are so many variables involved that, you know, GDP, our most basic measure, might be saying one thing, but other variables are saying something else. Like, for example, the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate has been edging up for quite a long time now, and it continues to move up. If you look at the inflation rate over the past 12 months, measuring from summer to summer, has been about 5%. If you look at initial job claims, those are up. Matter of fact, they were a little bit higher today than what most analysts said. And as a matter of fact, in the Wall Street Journal today, there were indicators that, you know, the vehicle sales in this country have really tailed off. The automobile industry is really starting to hurt, and hurt substantially.
Is it your opinion that we're in a recession now, or are we on the verge of one?
Okay, very good question. The general rule of thumb that most people hear about is, well, if we have two consecutive quarters of GDP, we're in a recession. That's mostly the common impression of that. Actually, what determines whether or not we're in a recession, is an organization called the National Bureau of Economic Research. They're the group that makes that call. And they look at a whole bunch of stuff. They just do not look at just GDP. They look at employment, various other variables that have an influence or on the economy. So the bottom line of it is, if you're looking at those numbers right now, it probably, from a technical standpoint, we are not in a recession. However, everything that is being gathered in terms of a future indicator of the economy suggests that we are starting to have a decline in economic activity, and we may very well be on the verge of a recession, maybe even technically in. If you talk to the average person in this country, with their wages being relatively stagnant, their income being stagnant, their home prices falling, and with inflation rising, they'll probably tell you that the economy is in much worse shape than what some of the official numbers do.
Well, Ed Miller, it really doesn't matter a lot in politics what the official numbers are. A lot of it matters on how the people feel at any given point in time, and a lot of people aren't feeling good right now.
That's right, and people are having difficulty certainly getting loans, and some people have lost their jobs. There's a fear that more jobs will be lost, and so this is clearly affecting the average person. However, so far it hasn't affected the bulk of the people. If it did, I think that there would be a different reaction in terms of communicating to their members. I do know that variety of interest groups, such as banks, chambers of commerce, and the business roundtable, have had a concerted effort since the defeat of the bill in the House. And so members are feeling that heat from these organizations, particularly those in their districts.
Let me get to a phone call, Randy. So just hold that thought. 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to Jim in Rothschild. Jim, you're on Route 51.
Hi, Glenn. I've got a question for both of your guests. One, the economic aspect. My candidate for president, unlike the Republican and Democrat, would do nothing at all to deal with the crisis. He would let American business build itself back up.
Who is your candidate?
Bob Barr.
Libertarian.
Yes. So economically, it would be painful, but it wouldn't last as long, and we'd get back to business in a relatively shorter time. Politically, I think it's interesting that both Republicans and Democrats are presidential candidates anyway, from the Senate, approved that bill, that awful bill that's as long as a novel, went from three pages to to hundreds of pages, and they both favor that, and 80% of the American people think the bailout is a terrible idea. Bob Barr agrees with them, and we don't hear anything about Bob Barr.
But Ed Miller, it's tough for third-party candidates to break through even in a year like this, isn't
true.
It?
That's true. That's true. But in terms of that particular area of not doing anything, just take a look at Japan. In Japan, they did do something, but not enough. It was a very, very weak response. And they've sort of been in economic recession for well over 10 years.
Jim, thanks so much for the phone call. I'm going to move on to another caller here. We've got William in Wausau. William, you're on Route 51. Good evening.
Good evening, Glenn. Hi. I hate to be a question hog, but my family and I were listening to your program, and we've kind of got some questions. Number one is, when will this plan affect, you know, our paychecks, and how much is it really going to affect us from day to day?
How's it going to affect the common person? It's again the proverbial Main Street versus Wall Street question. Randy, right. Why don't you take that?
Okay. Basically, I would try to explain it like this. I mean, a lot of people are probably already noticing that their 401ks and any other monies that they have set aside in various investments have probably lost a lot of value as of late. Since the beginning of the year, we've lost about $4.5 trillion worth of value. The other day, when we had the large plunge, I believe it was Monday, if I'm not mistaken, over $1 trillion was lost on that particular day. The bottom line of it is people are probably already now starting to see that in their, you know, their investments, their retirement accounts, the 401ks, especially in this day when defined pensions have been greatly reduced in terms of the number of companies offering those. A lot of individuals are now sort of, you know, left to their own devices to invest for their retirement. But more fundamentally, I think that how this would eventually play out on Main Street is that various businesses, you name it, construction, automobile, retail, small manufacturers, so on and so forth, will find it increasingly more difficult to get credit. One of the things that I teach is financial management at UWSP, and one of the things that I, you know, talk about is that if you look at the cash inflows and outflows of your typical business, especially small businesses, which tends to be the main generators of job growth in our economy, they tend to have problems in matching their inflows of cash with outflows. What does that mean? It simply means they need financing to be able to pay the bills, to be able to pay for the lights, for the various utilities, to be able to pay their people because of this mismatch in these and the timing.
Well, many people and all businesses depend on a line of credit. My question is, how quickly is this happening? Are there some businesses that are being squeezed already and are finding it impossible to meet payments because they can't get credit anymore?
But then also, if I can interject, the whole fact of what happened to the whole thing of living within your means. Why are we taking out so much credit? Why are we extending our shirt tails? I know that it induces payments in the economy and it's stimulating, but if we can't cover our own shirt tails, you know, my other question is, why should my great-grandchildren that I don't even know yet have to pay for debt of people we don't know who they are? Why am I paying for somebody else's debt when I have debt, too? Why am I bailing somebody out of their pocket when no one's bailing out of my pocket? Right.
Well, there's two different debts. One debt would be the debt that individual firms have, and they do borrow money to finance the firm. And so there's always this credit balance. You can think of credit as sort of the oil in the financial system. And if that oil dries up, I mean, that's actually the word they're using. The credit system will seize up. The financial system will seize up in that area. Now, in terms of the government itself, this gets really, really complicated because technically the government is buying these assets. Now, we don't know what they're going to buy the assets for. That's a complicated thing. If they buy them, if they don't pay enough, they're not going to help these firms. If they pay too much, then there may be some questions about its effect upon the government. But technically, in buying these assets, if they pay X amount for the asset, and the asset is essentially valued at that amount, they will be holding the asset. So there will be no net effect on the debt.
And, Randy, why don't you answer the first part of the question. How quickly is the credit seizing up? Is it happening already?
Based upon the information that I have come across, and basically this comes from the Federal Reserve, and if I think that there is any neutral, nonpartisan entity in our government, it would be our Federal Reserve. The information that has been brought forward out of the Federal Reserve, they have more information on the economy than just about any organization I can think of. They are certainly very, very concerned with regard to what they're seeing in terms of credit availability and of the seizing up of our financial system. I cannot imagine for the life of me why somebody like, say, Ben Bernanke would be so concerned about this unless he had information suggesting that this was, in fact, a very, very severe problem brewing on the horizon.
Randy, thanks. You're going to have to drop it there. And William, we have to move on. I want to thank you so much for the phone call, but we are starting to run short on time. You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. If you'd like to join the conversation, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
We're talking about the economy and about the political implications with Randy Cray and Ed Miller of UW Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We want to hear from you at 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Let's go back to the phones. We have Rad in Park Falls. Rad, you're on Route 51.
Hi, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I have a question about foreclosures on houses. I've heard a professor from, I can't remember, Madison or somewhere, that said that really California and Florida and Las Vegas were the three areas where we're seeing a great decline in home values. And then I just talked to my brother-in-law who's in Florida, and he mentioned that he has three friends just in his workplace who bought another home and then just walked away from their mortgages and were foreclosed on just because the values in Florida went down so much. They didn't have equity in the houses they were paying on, and they could get such good deals. And I would think that would actually skew the number if you just decided not to pay your mortgage because you had no equity in your home and you could get twice the home for half the price.
Well, in Wisconsin, we're having some problems, too, not as much as those other states, but in the southeast, Milwaukee area, there was an increase in September, 18% increase in the previous month in foreclosures. In the whole state, I believe the figure is about 10%, which is 2,066 foreclosures in September.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Randy, is this something that you're seeing nationally? You have
right.
People who are basically they were flipping houses, they were buying homes that they couldn't afford, thinking that they would appreciate in value and they'd be able to sell them at a profit.
Yeah, I mean, basically, this is something that was going all over the country, but the spots that were mentioned are certainly accurate as being maybe hotbeds of this kind of activity. But I'd like to also point out that, you know, the housing indicators basically are saying that, you know, prices are continuing to tumble across the nation in the markets, you know, 10 largest markets, 20 largest markets across the country. Since, like, mid-2007, housing prices nationally have fallen each and every month. And you look at the impact upon these foreclosures, the walking away, this creates a lot of inventory. this has had an impact upon new single-family housing starts. I mean, they've declined nationally from about 1.4 million starts in July of 2006 down to about 600,000 starts in July of 2008. That is a tremendous drop in the amount of construction activity. And one other statistic that I'll give you, sales of existing homes in 2006 in the summer were about 5.5 million units. By July of this year, down to about 4.4 million. So clearly, you put prices going down, number of starts going down. This is tied to the idea of, you know, the foreclosures and the difficulties in the housing market.
And let me just add to that, what Randy says is filters down to even beyond the housing market. You know, there are people who are making, especially in our area, windows for houses. There's people who are making, you know, various facilities, you know, whether
the window and door manufacturing industry is really big in central Wisconsin.
It is.
It is very big. If you look at some of our major employers in the area, many of them are related to household manufacturing, whether it's the house themselves or the windows or various components thereof. And all of the stuff that goes into housing, whether it's, you know, furniture, carpeting, you name it, a lot of stuff goes into that.
Rad, thanks so much for the phone call. Randy, do you think it would make sense, and Ed, I'll ask you if it would make sense to you politically, to do what some Democrats have been urging, which is to allow bankruptcy judges to, or foreclosure judges to rewrite the terms of these mortgages so that the little guys, the people who are
right,
losing their homes, are protected instead of just these big people on Wall Street.
Yeah, I'll do this very, very quickly. I do think that the root problem of all of this, as to the value of the securities, the value of the mortgages, and how they sit on the books of these financial institutions, is fundamentally predicated on the ability of individuals to pay those things and to make good on them. Anything that could be done to help individuals stay in those homes, to continue those payments, will add value to those securities and shore up the balance sheets of those institutions.
And in the bill, there's a directive to the asset managers rather than to the court. They decided not to do that because of interference with contracts, but the asset managers to restructure those mortgages.
We are quickly running out of time, so I do want to get into the blame game here before we leave. If you listen to conservative commentators, they're blaming Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and what they characterize as liberal Democrats and Barack Obama supporters who pushed subprime mortgages in order to increase the number of low-income homeowners. If you listen to liberal commentators, they blame Republicans who they say have systematically deregulated the economy because of their ideology of laissez-faire capitalism. They say Republicans like Herbert Hoover had that philosophy back in the 20s. It led to the Great Depression. And now Republicans like Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, and John McCain are pushing the same laissez-faire philosophy, and it threatens to create another Great Depression. So who's to blame here? Is it the conservative Republicans? Is it the liberal Democrats? Or is there enough blame to go around? And Randy, we'll let you take that first.
Okay, very, very briefly, I would say all of the above. I think that there is enough blame for this. I mean, we can sort out the blame after this, you know, situation is addressed, but clearly this thing was not set up properly. It was not regulated properly. That is the markets. Also, I think that from the other side, we had perhaps a little bit too much of social engineering with regard to trying to achieve certain social goals, so on and so forth. It was like the perfect storm coming together, and it just sort of fed on itself.
Yeah, and the deregulation is they felt that this market should operate, and the Glass-Steagall Act, which was enacted during the Depression to protect banks in this area and separate banks from a variety of trading operations, was eliminated. And some of that we're going to get back again after the first of the year.
Could it be that we just failed to learn the lessons of history? We had a Great Depression. We had stocks at one point that were leveraged, 10 to 1, and now we had these other financial institutions that were being leveraged up to 30 to 1.
Right. It seems like over the course of time, our memories become dulled as a society, as a country. And it appears that, the people that would have had remembrances of those periods, have slowly, passed on, so to speak. And we have generations now that really do not have a firsthand recollection of those situations.
Well, you know what? They've got a firsthand recollection of it now.
Yes.
Ed Miller.
And I don't know if it's comforting, but the chairman of the Federal Reserve is a specialist in the Depression. What is his dissertation?
And Ed, things do turn politically, and we may be seeing that this year if you look at least the latest opinion polls.
Right. We've got, 40 days or so before the election.
Ed Miller, Randy Cray, thank you so much for being with us, both of them on the faculty of UW Stevens Point. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Kelson Quisler. Thanks to all of you who called in with your questions and comments. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Now, this Monday night at 7 p.m. at the UW Marathon County Theater, Wisconsin Public Radio is a sponsor of an issue-oriented forum involving six state assembly candidates from central Wisconsin. Jerry Petruski and challenger Nate Mishka from the 86th District, Donna Seidel and her challenger Jess Kufall from the 85th District, and Scott Suter and his challenger Tim Swigum from the 69th District. The forum is open to the public. We encourage you to attend. That's this Monday night at 7, October 6th at the UW Marathon County Theater in Wausau, and we will have highlights next Thursday at 5 right here on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Thanks for joining with us today. That's it for us. Thanks for riding with us. Until next week, we are heading out of town.